Ja, alltså, jag blev ombedd att spela in det. Vi brukar, de vill träna sig lite på att spela in. Nej, vi bara spelar in det för att kunna ha det sen. För att jag har också en YouTube-kanal som heter Poranis Cosmology. Så du tänkte kan lägga den där också.
Ja, precis. Nej, vi började med sex
fritt. Okej, bra. Ha det bra.
Men den här
inspelningen
är med på
bilden? Alltså, så här. De som, vi ställde en kamera där. Jag vet inte om ni inte vill vara med. Vill ni inte vara med? För vi, vad vi tänkte var, jag skulle säga att de som inte vill vara med i bild kunde sitta där. Men ni kanske inte vill det. Så att om inte, vad vill du? För att det han filmar alla här. Vill du inte vara med eller?
Det syns inte.
Nej, men från den kameran syns hon. Men det här, alltså, hela den här presentationen är, den är... Vi får sudda ut hennes ansikte. Nej, låt den vara på. Let it be, otherwise we have no light here for filming. Both of them, full light. You can see anyway, right? Okay, I was asked to speak English, so I will do that. Is that okay for everyone? Because we also record it in English. Okay, anyway. Just det. Hallå.
Och
nu? So as we said, those who don't want to be in the video can sit over here, and because that camera will show everyone, just to get some environmental. But we can also blur your face if you don't want to be involved. Det kanske bara blir ett tomt rum för dig då. Nobody wants to be in the video. Okay, shall we start? So, can I start? Okay, here is Bhaktini. So, I was told to speak in English, so here we start. And, yeah. My name is Privata, you all know that. And we're going to look at the cosmology of the Puranas of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And this is from a book that I'm currently writing about that, which is, well, the result of like 25 years of my studies of this. And in case someone doesn't know, I just made this presentation also for those who don't know much, but I don't know, maybe you need to know something about the Bhagavatam, but the Temple of Vedic Planetarium, that's what, well, this is about, because the Temple of Vedic Planetarium, as we know, is meant to be an exhibition about the cosmology of the Bhagavatam, and this is how it looks like today, more or less, I think. And it's supposed to open in, what is it, next year, autumn or something, if God wants, I guess. And, well, where it started, and this is also where I came into it first, 1980, then it looked like this in Mayapur. And I came there, springtime for Gurpurnim, and Of course, those who don't know, which everyone does anyway, Srila Prabhupada, Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada had founded this and ISKCON. And together with his godbrother, Sridhar Swami, they had a vision for a planetarium right here that would show the cosmology of the Bhagavatam and the ancient Indian view on the cosmos. But he wanted it scientifically valid, not just as a kind of, you know, old Indian culture in general, so that intellectuals from all over the world can come here and see that this view on the cosmos that they had back then is even better than the one we have now. So I was just a couple of days after, there would be a presentation by these scientists from Bhaktivedanta Institute, which Prabhupada also had founded. Richard Thompson there, and the others, they're all like PhDs and physicists and mathematicians. And they were going to explain the cosmos of the Bhagavatam. So I was like, yeah. I was interested in science and how there is science in the Bhagavatam, which is as good as or even better than the modern Western science. So they put up posters there of the cosmos, and they looked like this. So here we have the cosmos. It's a bubble half filled with water. And there's this disk there, which is the earthly planetary system. And in the middle, there's this mountain made of gold called Meru. And on top of that live the gods. And then the sun is going around on that outer island. There are seven circular islands. And in the middle, he pointed, I got a scientist standing there explaining this. He pointed at one of those little mountains and said, "This is Himalaya, and this is where you are right now." So I remember standing there, wow, okay, this is the cosmos. And having, I guess, the same questions as many of us have, and you know, since we first learned about this, and, you know, accept it on faith, so to speak. But then skip ahead 17 years, and I'm back in Mayapur, and learn then about this. This was just, you know, on the drawing table at that time. And, well, got a phone call from the SNPDC, the leaders of this whole project, and they wanted a production manager and conceptual designer for the exhibitions. This is going to be filled with exhibitions. And they wanted me for some reason. And I was like, wow. I just got out of being a temple president in Gothenburg and gave it over to this guy. And I was happy. I could just, you know, chant and study. And so first I said no, but then, you know, got into that. And it was quite interesting because Prabhupada, he wanted three floors. I got a file there with the direct instructions Prabhupada had given to Harikesh Swami and Jack Patak Swami that I studied, really. Three floors, one representing each world, three worlds, Devi Dham, Mahesh Dham, and Hari Dham, and a planetarium and some other exhibitions going on in there. So, and yes, I was going then to figure out and getting connected with artists from all over the world, ISKCON Krishna artists, and we were going to make exhibitions in there. So I thought, well, before we, you know, get into the creative work and buy all the expensive machinery and all that, maybe we should figure out what actually the cosmology of the Bhagavatam is. We have to understand it first. So that's basically what I spent the last, you know, 25 or so years with doing on my own, because personal reasons and, you know, the leadership changed there in 98. So I kind of went more back into my own studies of the Bhagavatam. And what I'm going to say here is the result of my research, okay? Which is a little different from others that you might hear about this cosmology of the Bhagavatam, but it's strictly the Bhagavatam itself. So I really try to stay away from speculations. So, but it's going to be a little different maybe than many are expecting. Now, this is Sadaputta, who I then learned to know. We became friends, and I spent a lot of time with him. He's one of the scientists you saw there. Lived there in northern Florida, and where the Bhaktivedanta Institute still is, in Gainesville, Alachua, this is. And, well, it was quite interesting because, you know, on his wall he still had these posters of this cosmos. So we were talking about, you know, what... And he, I can understand he had a very different point of view now about this, you know. And one thing he told me then, very interesting, that two things that really struck a chord in me in our discussions was that this kind of model, in principle, is not there only in India, but you find it actually in all over the world. So, you know, you find it in the old Babylonian cosmos 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, the Chinese cosmology, all over Asia actually, Tibet, Bhutan. I just picked some pictures here. But also in America, South America, North America, and it's always very similar. There's a disk here, which is the Earth, and there's a central axis where there's a mountain or a tree or a pillar of some sort. And then there's an upper world, a lower world, and the in-between world, which is then Earth, the way we are. And it's all in a kind of bubble with water under it. And so I was quite amazed why they are so similar. You find that similar denominator in cultures which you never thought had any contact with each other. So I took my pen and paper and made a little sketch of what's kind of common between them. And you find there's an axis in the middle, sometimes called Meru, sometimes axis Mundi. There's a middle world disk like that. There's an upper world and a lower world and some water, and it's all in a kind of ball. So that, what does this mean, was the question. And Sataputta, he made another point then, I remember. He said that, and there are other scientists also who were kind of making the same point, who were looking at this, that there is something to it, but we don't know what it is. We need to look at it, that was his conviction, from a different perspective, from a different point of view than we Westerners especially are used to. So that really struck a chord in me. You have to find a different point of view here. And what is that point of view? So that kind of became my, how to say, quest for the next 25, 20 years, that what is that point of view that really makes this all make sense, this strange image of the Bhagavatam? And now I can say, honestly, after 20 years, I think I found it. And this is what I'm going to present to you here tonight. And it could be a little mind-blowing, so you have to really stay with me here. But two points of view, and so help me God, that I can explain it, that you give us all intelligence to figure it out. Because I think it's quite, and that's, I guess, what Pranava Professor Sardella invited me here, because he obviously seemingly thinks there's something to it, I hope. Anyway, so different points of view. This is, you know, when we say cosmos, most people think of this, right? Some big space with planets and galaxies and stuff in it. And, well, actually, that's one point of view. And you could show it like this. I call it the physicalist point of view. Physicalism is a, you can say it's a philosophical assumption behind modern science, the science which is a materialistic science, where they presume that there only is the physical world, right? That's the materialist science. There is nothing but the physical world. And then, of course, the universe, the cosmos, is just the physical space, right? So in Western cosmology, you often mix it with astronomy. It's kind of the same, right? It's all about planets and stuff in this space. Of course, it's very big, but just the idea, it's kind of object that we look at. Now, many devotees who got into this this project there about the Puranic cosmology, we were kind of conditioned with this view. So we're looking there, you know, in the fifth canto of the Bhagavatam, there is something there about planets and orbits and all that. That's science. So we should try to get that together with, you know, what science here. But it is from a physicalist, materialist view on the cosmos. So there is another point of view here. And this is actually one that the quantum physicists, which I will talk about later, more came up with. And well, actually, it's very simple. Well, it looks a little strange, maybe. It's the view we have right now. Right now, well, we live in three realms right now, actually. This physical, the world of the senses that we see here. But then we have a mind. There are thoughts and things going on in there. And when we sleep at night, we are in that mind world. It's a world, actually. And when we are there, we think it's reality, actually. And then we have the intellect. So when you listen to me now, you're using your intellect trying to figure out what this guy is saying. It's there. It's a kind of brilliant level of our existence here. And then outside that, there's a mind where all these thoughts and images and feelings and all of that are going on. It's a factual existence. And then out there we have the realm of the senses, this world that we see. So actually what happened in quantum physics is that by their experiments and all kinds of things, and I mean, we don't need to get into that, but they came to the conclusion we have to accept, and of course the I there is us, the what they call the conscious observer, and we call the Atma, right? The one behind it all. And what they did, which was a very big thing actually that happened in science with quantum physics, that they had to include the conscious observer in the whole system. Physicalists, they deny the existence of anything except this. But here we simply accept this as the cosmos, including the physical, the mental, and the higher levels. So when I looked at this, I thought, this might be the point of view. Because actually, when you think of it, this is also how the Bhagavatam and this knowledge that we have describes things. We are the Atma, we have an intelligent buddhi, and then manas, our mind, and then indriya, the senses. So keep this in mind, because we'll get back to it. It's a little kind of inside looking out point of view. And this is an important thing that I want to point I want to make. Cosmology is not astronomy. That's what they mix up when they are in this. I think it's almost the same here in the West, right? But here, it's not astronomy, but it's cosmology, but it includes also the mind and this consciousness. And there are actually physicists, there are scientists today, I mean, there's serious discussions going on that, for instance, what's his name? Famous philosopher, anyway, who said that we have to include consciousness in as a fundamental of this world. We can't just pretend it's not there. So there are these things going on. So don't ask me here if the Earth is flat or round or any of that, if the moon is further away than the sun or all these things. That's astronomy. There's nothing about that in the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam, it goes on cosmology, very high level knowledge actually. Astronomy is in the Vedangas, that's like auxiliary, more mundane topics of the Vedic knowledge. So there is astronomy in the Bhagavatam also, but a very different kind of astronomy than our modern one. And if somebody wants, I could say something about that in the end, but then you have to ask me because there's limited time here. The cosmology of the Srimad Bhagavatam. I guess most here have read the Srimad Bhagavatam, or who has? So you're kind of familiar with Bhagavatam, discussion with Maharaj Parikshit and Shukadeva Goswami. Maharaj Parikshit has 1 week left to live. He asks the wisest man in his country, what shall I do now with these 7 days? And what Shukadeva Goswami does, he starts actually describing the Vishvarupa, the cosmic form of God. Just like we, the soul in this body, have, this is our body, our little microcosm. This entire cosmic manifestation is the body of the God, of the Garbhodaka, the Purusha. So he starts describing that, saying that when you understand how God, this is the presence of God around you, then you will not be an illusion anymore, and you will see things the way they are. And then when you die, you will be liberated like that. So you could say the Bhagavatam, some think that the cosmology of the Bhagavatam is in the fifth canto, because there's something about planets and orbits and all of that. They look for astronomy, right? But the entire Bhagavatam is about cosmology. And it starts with that, actually, describing the cosmos, but as a form of God. So it's all a very personal and consciousness-centered cosmology. And we also find it, actually, if you look at the 10 topics, departments of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the Puranas, the 18 Mahapuranas, they have 5 topics, generally said, and one of them is cosmology. The Bhagavatam, which is the most famous and the major one of them, has 5 more, and these 10. And we see here, and I say that this entire, it's kind of a cycle, this knowledge, if you've never thought about that. Sarga is the first one, creation, the first level, we'll look at that soon. Visarga, second level of creation. And then when the creation has happened, and sthanam means that, because creation is there for all of us jivas to get into this world, and it's kind of a dream, actually, which we'll get to. Then sthana means we need a place to stay, planetary systems, and portion and protection, so we can live peacefully. And then utaya, creative impetus, well, then we start getting families and make our life here in this world. So it kind of explains why we come down here to enjoy ourselves. And then gradually, manvantara, there's dharma, there is spiritual knowledge coming in, the science of God, which then Maharaj Parikshit learned from Shukadev. And gradually, okay, it's over with this, now I want to wake up to reality again. Nirodha, winding up, and mukti, liberation, and ashraya, back home. And that's, in a way, the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam, you're back with Krishna, right? So, I just want to say this entire Bhagavatam is about cosmology, but a very different one than this space and planets and some, you know, sitting there with their calculators trying to figure out distances and all this mundane stuff. So maybe someone recognizes this. This is basically the cosmology of the Bhagavatam. Mahavishnu lying down in the causal ocean, sleeping. Then these eggs, golden eggs coming out, these bubbles. Within each one is lying down again as Garbhagashaya Vishnu, sleeping, dreaming. And then in that lotus stem coming out from him, he enters again as Kshirdagashaya Vishnu. So in short, this is the entire cosmic creation according to the Bhagavatam. And again, what does this all mean? Well, first of all, this is another point of view which actually I think is very important to see. This world is God's dream. Does anyone disagree with that? Or you don't dare to, but it's Mahavishnu's dream, right? That's how you find in the Bhagavatam. And actually, it's our dream too, because we are little rays from the Purusha, so we are also in here in some kind of dream. And actually, Swarup Prabhu, who used to be in the BBT, he came to me at the end of the 90s and said, you know, I found something fantastic. This is all a dream. And I don't understand what you're talking about. And then he gave me a file this thick with papers, with quotes he had cut from Prabhupada and from Shastra and Bhagavatam, saying exactly that this world is a dream. Maya means it's a dream. And I know something, and actually this is a direct quote from the Bhagavatam, and I can show you a whole pile of proof for this, actually. And there's a very, very important lecture that Prabhupada gave in Tokyo, 1972, 23rd of April, on the Bhagavatam 291, which Swarup and those, they managed to get a piece of it into that book that the GBC produced, because there was this controversy then, did you fall down from Vaikuntha or not? Have you heard about this? Where do we come from? How can we fall down if we are with Krishna in the spiritual world? If we fall down, and then we are fools. And are we fools in the spirit? I mean, but Prabhupada says there in that lecture and in other places too, although disciples didn't really understand it, we never fell down from Vaikuntha. We are in Vaikuntha now, because that's our constitutional position. We just dream. We just fell into a dream. And he says this over and over again in the lecture. He said this is a very important point, because they understand that we can get out of this at a second like this, by waking up. It's not that Vaikuntha is somewhere far away. And it's quite interesting point here. So actually, this dream concept, so to speak, I then thought, okay, let's look at this creation story of the Bhagavatam from that point of view. That try to see, okay, does Bhagavatam describe everything as a dream? And it's quite interesting. It gets a little difficult. So I hope, you know, questions we can have then afterwards. So trying to explain it simply. This is in the first level, Sarga. Mahavishnu sleeping, and this, as is described, it's all there in the Bhagavatam, is Sushupti. It's the state of sleep with no dreams yet. When we fall asleep at night, we can actually use our own dreams as a kind of metaphor here. We tend to first go into deep sleep, no dreams, and that's where we really rest. And then Freud, for instance, he was talking about this, that dreams actually are part of what he called the dream work, where from the subconscious or unconscious, these dreams are born. They are kind of bubbling up, so to speak. So yes, there are bubbles coming out from Mahavishnu. And this stage here, you can say, it is the stage where, I don't know if I dare to really get into it, but I try to illustrate this. This is a part of actually there in the Bhagavatam, so to make it easy to understand. I just make it short. You have Mahavishnu there and Mahalakshmi, and they're going, you know, there's this dream there, and this whole chunk there is actually the dream world. And we can just take the example when we fall asleep. First, we kind of drift away from here. And then there is a dream world, right? There's maybe nothing in there yet, but we enter into some kind of other realm, right? And that can be compared to this. And it's called Mahatattva in the Bhagavatam. And Prabhupada describes, he says, the Mahatattva is the shadow of pure consciousness. It is pure goodness with a slight addition of the material mode of passion. So this chunk here represents the material world, which is consciousness little bit affected with gunas. And what are the gunas? Goodness, passion, and ignorance. They actually like part of a creative thing. Like passion means we want to create something. Goodness, there's no need for that. So it kind of describes the creative cycle within this world. So then when we dream, we enter into that dream, and then we have a dream persona, a character inside the dream, right? I mean, when you dream at night, you can do it next time. Look at your hand, and you will see you have a hand in the dream, and you have a body. It's actually a way to wake up in the dream and become lucid in the dream. Actually, I learned it. We used to do this with some devotees a long time ago, experimenting with dreams. But that kind of persona we have there, that we then start acting in that dream, is of course not us. It's a false ego. So here we have the same thing, that when Vishnu kind of, and this is pointed out in the Bhagavatam clearly, that when Vishnu gets into that dream, he's not falling under the modes of nature and becoming illusioned by it. It's for his pastimes. And actually the whole creation is about creating this place for us to fall into illusion or have fun. So then what happens there in this Mahatattva is this ahankara developing, that dream persona, which is Shiva. Shiva represents the ahankara. This is all Bhagavatam. and Parvati. So, and Shiva is Vishnu, just like milk and yogurt, but also exactly not exactly. So it's a very nice way of explaining it like that. And then in that dream, we can just take quickly the other ones. First, there is mind, which is ahankara in sattvaguna. It's just a clear space. Like if we enter a dream before anything is there, we just have a mind in there also, right? We can think and so on. Nothing is really going on. But then when ahankara gets in the mode of rajaguna, then intelligent senses start to work. Action, you know, we want this, we want that. It's creativity is going on. That's raja. And then next one is ahankara in tamaguna. And that's where the senses are, of course, actually belonging to us, the spiritual body, like that. But they start acting in there, and then the sense objects appear, and they are called the mahabhutas. And you know the elements, five elements, space and air and all of those. Sometimes we see them as physical, some kind of substances or something like that. But actually in the Bhagavatam it's described differently, that the sense of hearing, the ether is actually coming from the sense of hearing. So when the sense of hearing enters into this dream world, then that object of it, sound, appears and so on. When the sense of touch enters into this world, then the element of air, because air is like the pulse that, you know, that kind of force. So in this way, all the sense perceptions that we have here in this world that makes it seem real to us are actually coming that way, from the Mahabhutas. It's from the other way seen. I don't know if anyone can understand this, but it's like a virtual view on the world, like a virtual reality thing or something. We will get to that. So just take a little rest here. Now we have an egg floating on the causal ocean for 1,000 whatever years in that time. That's the Bhagavatam saying. Now an egg is an interesting, because an egg represents fertility and what do you say? What do you call it when something is growing inside the egg?
Reproduction.
Yeah, you know, when there's an embryonic stage like that. And this is called garbha, and garbha means womb. So this egg is like, you know, now it's time for this universe to grow and happen in here. Before, we only had the basic elements, so to speak.
Creation.
Yeah, this, yeah. So then we have Garbhadakshaya Vishnu there also with Lakshmi Devi. And he's dreaming, and as he dreams, well, it says here the Supreme Personality of God, it impregnates this egg in the womb of material nature with this virya, likened to semen, and there appears Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. And he's dreaming, and then appears, again, it's like a seeding, you know, starting to grow, that this lotus, on top of which Brahma then takes birth. And that lotus actually, this is again Bhagavatam, it contains the Virata Rupa, this Vishvarupa, which really is this cosmos that we are in now. This is the level. You could see it like this, that Garbhadakshaya Vishnu dreams, and then Vishvarupa appears, and then he enters into that as Kshiradakshaya Vishnu, again ruling that realm. And then Brahma appears there on top of the lotus. It's like entering into that dream. You know, when we dream at night, there's a dream there, but we then, whoops, we are sucked into it, and we think, now I'm in it, and it's for real. And that's where we are now. We're kind of, otherwise it wouldn't be fun if we thought this is just a stupid dream, right? We want to have it to be real. And there are interesting stories in different cultures about a god who creates a world and then wakes up inside it. So, and this is pretty much Brahma's role or something like that. So it's kind of, or actually our role. So I don't know if anyone can follow. But here we are, Kshiradakshaya Vishnu enters into the Vishvarupa, And he's then in the heart of every living being, and also we recognize this one, into every atom, thus nourishing and upholding this entire Vishva. And that is then what Shukadev spoke to Maharaj Parikshit about, that this you should understand, the presence of God here now. So, yeah, and then you got Brahma, the firstborn. He wakes up in the lotus and he populates the worlds, different life forms according to gunas. That whole story is given in the Bhagavatam, I think the third canto or so, or fourth. So that is basically the creation story of the Bhagavatam, very, very much in a nutshell. So I just tried to take all these descriptions from the Bhagavatam and put them together into some kind of image. I don't have no idea if anyone can follow, but I'll just take it quickly here. You have this macrocosmic and the microcosmic point here of view. One, macrocosmic means Vishnu Tattva, that's God, whose body this entire world is. Macrocosmic is the Jiva, it's us, who are little rays from God, right? So God sleeps. This is going on in Turiyas, in reality, Vaikuntha, the real world. Sleep can go on there also, obviously, otherwise how could God sleep? And we can also sleep. But sleep there is not, as far as I understand, and it's not like this ignorant thing that it is here, but it's more creative. You can imagine anything and make it come true like that. And then when God is sleeping, Narayan there, when he takes the form of Mahavishnu there, Karana Dakashaya Vishnu, in that state of Sushupti, and we also there in his body like that. And then it goes on, and you see there's a macro and microcosmic correspondence here. So the next level, Garbha Dakashaya Vishnu, as we spoke about, the dreaming up of the worlds that then will become the cosmos. And then that lotus there coming down, and that is the Vishvarupa with seven lokas, waking up in the dream, you could say. And then this whole cosmic manifestation is finally as, you know, concrete as it seems here. It looks very real, right? But we are also going down into that, and we live there in some of those lokas. But we have those same seven in us in form of the chakras. So there is a correspondence between the macro and microcosm there. This is the microcosm. And Purusha body in the Vishva is the macrocosm. So that's basically the idea. Now the lokas, I just need to get that also in here. Sometimes we thought lokas mean planet or something, but actually it's related to the Latin word locus, or location. So it means a realm for those of a certain mode of nature. So here are those, you know, with kind of passion, Rajaguna people, we take birth in this world. Sattvaguna, then you are up in Svarga, you know, heaven or something like that. So this way of describing it, I find in the Bhagavatam, but it's also quite basic in the Vedic knowledge, so trust me that this is not speculative. I'll just take it quickly here that, you know, we have this body, physical body. It's called Stula Sharira in Sanskrit. It's made of Annamaya, the material, so to speak, is Annamaya Kosha. Annam is food, so it's made of food. Very practical. And it exists in this world, which is called Bhurloka. And Bhu comes from the word bhava, which means coming into existence and then leaving again. So we take birth here and then, whoops, we leave. So that's describing this world very well. Now, when we fall asleep at night, our senses, so to speak, we pull out of these. We're not looking through these senses anymore. We pull out of that and we go into the dream world. And then we are in our subtle body, which is called Sukshma Sarira, which is made of two, Pranamaya Kosha and Manamaya Kosha. I hope you're still with me somewhere. I've been really pumping a lot of things at once here, but I find it interesting. Pranamaya kosha is the energy body, prana, the pranic body, the qi body in China. It's you know, I think it has to do much with electricity because, you know, the power in the muscles and all this energy flowing. And it's in this body, but it's invisible from here, from the Bhuvaloka. So it's there in Bhuvaloka. Manamaya is the mind, the subtle body. Again, when we dream at night, we can experience that we have a body, and that is this Sukshma Sharira. So when we die, what happens if I would leave this body now and die? I'm pulled out of Bhuvaloka level, out of this Stula Sharira. I'm in my Sukshma Sharira. And Bhuvaloka is also divided into two, Pretaloka and Pitriloka. Pretaloka means the world of the dead. And some think that it means a world of ghosts. But it really means that when you leave the body, we are still in the room here. We still see this room. People who have this out-of-body experience, they still see this room, right? So we are very close to this Bhuvaloka, but we are not in it. We're looking into it. And if you are a ghost, that's where you are. You don't get away from that. You're still kind of earthbound. But you, when you, soon as we leave the body, and I heard from this Tibetan Book of the Dead, for instance, that when you're dead, you stay for like 40 days or so around in that room where you died. So that kind of fits in here. And then you're ready to go to the next. So Bhuvaloka is also called the judgment realm. And it is ruled by Yamaraj, who is the judge. Sometimes people say, oh, Yamaraj comes and he will take me and I will go to hell. But what it means is that you are judged there. If you are a more goodness person, then you are led further up to where you belong, to Svarga. That's where the goodness people live. If you are an ignorant person, then you go down to the world, the Tama, you know, the Talas or whatever. So Bhuvaloka is a kind of in between, like a station where you go before you continue. That's how it is described in Bhagavatam. And then behind there is, of course, the Atma. So we are projected into it like that. And again, this is a kind of dreamy realm, so to speak. So here, okay, this model again, which we started with, which looked very strange. If we look at it this way, that the middle world, that's Bhuvaloka, this world where we're in now, and then the next one is Bhuvaloka, and they are then on subtle platforms outside of this. So we don't look for these inside space here or something like that. The space we see here is that disk there. That's how it's imagined or imaged. So it gets a little bit more, you know, and this mirror is said also to be like that. Prabhupada said that the yogis can travel between the worlds along the merudanda, as he called it, which is also actually the spinal column in our microcosmic realm like that. So, science. You know, we're talking here that Prabhupada wanted real science here, and he said that this cosmology of the Bhagavatam is very scientific and it should be presented in that way. So I just want to say a little bit about quantum theory, quantum physicists, because they actually came to a point of understanding the cosmos very similar to Bhagavatam that we just talked about. And I'm going to try and show how, but it's very difficult to do. It's so short, so therefore I have to write a book. When I went to school, this is what everything was made of, atoms. Molecules built out of them, little plastic balls we had, I remember, in classroom. Yes, most of us got it that way. I don't know about you in India. But then actually, the quantum physicist, David Bohm, right down to the right there, is, I think, the smartest of them. He writes in his book, he says that when quantum physics came and relativity theory with Einstein, they agreed on one thing, that they see this cosmos not as made of little building blocks like this, but as one energy, holistic view, which is kind of vibrating in different ways, and there's a dynamic in it. And he compared it to, let's say you have a stream of water, a river or something, you sometimes see little whirlpools, right? And they appear to be static still, right? But it's actually just the flow of water. So he said it's the same, there's an energy flowing like this. Sometimes it makes whirls like this, vortexes, and that's what atoms are. So you just have to trust what he said there. But what is important here is that this is a holistic understanding of the cosmos. And thus this scientist, Max Planck, he's the most famous, he's the grandfather of quantum theory. He says this, I mean, quite amazing statement here. I can tell you as a result of my research about atoms, there is no matter as such. It exists only by virtue of force. And then in the end he says something even more mind-blowing. We must assume behind this force the existence of a conscious and intelligent mind. This mind is the matrix of all matter. And this is one of those that many scientists today, they just ignore. But he was actually not alone about this. Here's one, James Jeans, co-founder of British Cosmology. I incline to the idealistic theory that consciousness is fundamental and that the material universe is derivative from consciousness, not the other way around. In general, the universe seems to me to be nearer to a great thought than to a great machine. And again, back to this one. That's why I say that these men started seeing it that way. Because here, what is actually going on, those of you who came here, you don't know. This means actually how we see things. The red eye there is Atma, that's us, the conscious observer, as it's called in quantum physics. And then we have, you know, the level of the intellect, the mind, and the senses. So the quantum physicists said that all this is part of the system which we then call the cosmos. So they started, they moved over the fundamental part of the cosmos from this space of matter to the actual conscious observer, who they started to see more and more fundamental. And this is a big shift that happened. And this view here, which is called, this is actually the idealistic view. And in philosophy, there are two main philosophies, philosophy maybe no or not no. The materialist philosophy, which is what we much have dominating the Western science, and idealist philosophy, like Plato and those philosophers, which says, I'm looking at Wikipedia here, idealism, it means the perspective that reality is equivalent to mind, spirit, or consciousness. So you can say it's a philosophy behind religions and I mean, the most common and dominating philosophy historically, and still today, I mean, only 10% of the people I read believe that we don't live after, you know, death, that we are just a body. So it's still quite dominant, but of course, many people, they don't think of it that way. So again, as in contrast to this physicalist, materialist point of view, I mean, we have these universes of nature with thought, a sensation in the universe of mind, the world stuff of the world is mind stuff. He's also founder of British Cosmology. These men that were going into that idealist, consciousness-centered point of view, looking at cosmology, which is, you know, how much do we hear about that when we read about physics in school? Erwin Schrödinger, big famous one with Schrödinger's cat and all that, the only reality is consciousness. Everything else is just illusion. And he became a Vedantist. And these men, they started actually turning to India. Niels Bohr, the founder of the most famous one, the Copenhagen Interpretation of Quantum Physics, Danish, of course, he got, what do you call it, knighted by the king in Denmark. And he got this coat of arms. Then he put the Tai Chi symbol there because he was into Taoism. And he said that I go into the Upanishads to ask questions. He's quoted as saying that. I'm not sure exactly if it's true, but very often quoted, so I believe so. Werner Heisenberg, also a big one. Quantum theory will not look ridiculous to people who have read Vedanta. And David Bohm, who I will talk more about, he became friends with Krishnamurti and had discussions with him about this, again, this holistic understanding of the cosmos. It's not made of little particles. It's not fragmented, and we are all part of that. I mean, they were a bit Advaita Vedantists, of course, but at least they got that far. So those men, quantum physicists, I mean, they are big, all Nobel Prize winners. They started looking at the cosmology that we are talking about now, the Vedantic, which the Bhagavatam is, and seeing, hey, this makes sense, because here consciousness is fundamental. It's quite fantastic what they, you know, how they did that. And here is David Bohm and another very interesting person called Carl Pribram. He's a neurosurgeon, a neuroscientist, brain expert, described by his peers as the Einstein of brain science. And here he is with Bhakti Swarup Damodar Goswami, who is from the Bhaktivedanta Institute, disciple of Prabhupada. Quite interesting how they met. Now, he and David Bohm, those two, I know it's becoming a little bit difficult, but I'm going to go very quickly here. They got into this theory that actually quantum physicists said that we don't know what's out there. This is what the classical quantum theory says, that we all we can discuss is our knowledge of reality. You know, what we see here, for instance, this room, you don't see the room right now. You see the image in the mind that is created from, I mean, even the images in the eyes, there are little ones upside down, two of them. So they are mixed together into a nice 3D image that we see in our mind. So we see a mental image now, and we don't know what's going on out there. So therefore, quantum physics, they stopped there and said, we only know our knowledge about reality. And Bohm was not satisfied with that, because he thought, what do you mean? We have to also try to understand what is actual reality is out there. So he came up with, again, this I said about, you know, atoms and all that being an energy, waves and all that. The light in this room, for instance, that makes us see, you can describe it as a light field. It's like all the waves coming from all the light sources, they're bouncing around here, mixing into a kind of interference pattern. Very much like a hologram, actually, and that's why David Bohm called this the holonomic or holographic theory about it. I'm going to keep myself short here, and then Carl Pribram, he found that in the brain, the information that goes in there that we actually are looking at now is in the brain. Where is that image in the brain? Often they think that it's there in the little brain cells. But he could show you that no, they can't be there, because if a brain gets damaged, I don't know if it was that much, but one part of the brain gets damaged, then another part takes over. They call it neuroplasticity, I think it's called. So he wondered, why is this? And he came to that conclusion that the image is there in the field. There's an electromagnetic field around the brain. We can measure it with EEG. In a kind of also similar way as here, is stored as a kind of information structure in a pattern of waves. So they were working on this. Now, what this means here, if you look at it, you see someone is looking at someone out there, but the image is there. Out there, we don't really know what it is. There's some kind of energy there. Frequencies, of course, we know this is electromagnetic light coming and the sound waves, same thing. It's just waves coming in. Images in there. And therefore, they got into this more of a virtual understanding of the world. That's what quantum physics came into. And if you don't know what that means, and I'm back to this one again, I'm calling it the virtual cosmos. It means that what you see out there is actually in the mind, and what's out there, you don't know. So it's all virtual means something that is, you could say, in our consciousness. And I'm just going to get in this little funny ending to this because it's pretty interesting. In school I learned a real image. If you have a painting on the wall, that's a real image. You can touch it. It's just there, physical object. But if you look at yourself in a mirror, for instance, it's a virtual image. The picture you see in the mirror is not there, right? It's in your mind. So virtual means that it's created by light, but out there behind the mirror, there's just, you know. So virtual means it exists in relation to our consciousness. Actually, the word is interesting. It's an old word. It comes from, you know, it means by virtue. So virtue means in India, like virya, it actually is related to the Sanskrit word virya, something that exists in terms of an energy or something that affects our consciousness like that. So now we get into this, the virtual reality. Has anyone ever had one of those on? You know, first time you do that, I actually developed a computer game, a virtual computer game once. And when you put that thing on, the first thing you say probably is, wow, isn't it? It's amazing. You are in a different world. You can walk around in it. You can turn around, look all over. It's there. And little pixels like that, but it's very bright and, you know. So I remember I was working with that game. I was standing inside a world. It was for a dentist company. So I was standing in a dentist office that I was building inside there. And when I took off that mask, I was like bewildered. It was some gray, strange room sitting in front of my computer. And I realized, oh, this is my, you know, this is reality, so to speak. It's so, the mind is so quickly captured, isn't it? I mean, it's amazing. And, you know, I was in there, I stood there, there was a table and a bottle on the table. You had a controller in your hand, sometimes there's a glove. I could take the bottle and I could feel it in my hand. And I threw it in the wall, and the little pieces came tinkling on the floor. And then I thought, if we would make that even better, let's say we include perfect touch sensation and smell and touch, taste, it would be indistinguishable from reality. It would become our reality. So this actually shows that, I mean, I'm using this as a metaphorical example. You can construct the whole cosmology from this virtual, you see, because what all that matters to us ultimately is if we can touch it, see it, hear it, smell it and taste it and so on. You understand what I mean? If there is actually anything out there, an object, that's irrelevant. So this is kind of the virtual understanding of it. And, well, you know, you just have little pictures like that which simulate that. It's just an energy coming in and, again, creating an image in our minds that to us then become like a reality. So this is much what they came more into. And now the final thing gets really kind of mind-blowing here. There was one philosopher, an Oxford philosopher, his name is Boström, he's Swedish actually. He wrote a paper beginning of 2001 or something, where he said that this world we live in might be a simulation. And the reasoning was very interesting. He said that we are now making these VR games and VR worlds and simulate realities with our computers. If we go on like this, I mean, if you look at how fast that developed from, I mean, very primitive just a few years ago, in 50 years, even if it doesn't go as fast as now, we will be able to make perfect virtual reality that is indistinguishable from reality. And then the next thing comes, maybe we did that already, and maybe we are in that now. And they even, Elon Musk is into that. There's a few of them in Silicon Valley. There's really a hip kind of thing going on there. But there's science behind it, actually. And I heard that someone offered, the two billionaires, that offered money to those who can help us to get out of the simulation. which I find interesting. Now, there are these things, you know, they're showing that actually there are scientific evidence that actually can give us some suspicion that this is all a simulation. And one then is that the physical laws are very fine-tuned, and if they were just a little bit off, there would be no cosmos. So this implies intelligent design, which means there could be programmers behind it. It can be, the world nature can be described mathematically. Even some mathematicians, they are speaking about the code behind this entire nature, which again suggests coding, coders behind the world. And for those who know quantum physics, says here, quantum physics tells us that the forms in this world are only rendered when perceived by a conscious observer. The collapse of the wave function, as they call it. This is similar to the programming technique used for computer games called on-demand rendering, where the objects inside the game world are only rendered when looked at by the player. That's to save computer power and all that. So they have things like that. Some say the space-time can be quantized, meaning it's composed of little finite units. For instance, there's a pixel size, Planck length. And of course this, the game over. One day this is over. And that very fact can also lead one to suspect that this is indeed only, you know, not real reality, but something like a game. So now this is game over for today, and now you decide you want to play again or exit. But that's the thing. When I heard about these, I mean, pretty wild speculations, I thought like this, that if we come to the point of having this technology where we can actually make perfect simulated world, they tend, of course, to think in terms of computer machines, but maybe we then have a much higher form of technology, maybe going directly on the mind or plugging right into the brain and then creating that perfect world. And then it starts to look pretty much like the cosmology of the Bhagavatam, where we say it's like a dream. Now, a dream and a virtual reality simulation are not very different. It's all happening in our minds here. So, and if you look again at this, you have it there. It's like, you know, we are in a game. We came here to have fun, and then after a while we realize it's time to leave. So in that way, actually, I hope that I managed to describe a little bit how I find that here we find the kind of the Bhagavatam and certain, you know, parts of modern science fit together. So I'm trying to write that book, and hopefully something along this line could be useful for the exhibitions there in Mayapur, because again, Prabhupada didn't want just some Hindu folklore things there. He wanted real science, actually. And I don't know, I think that somewhere along, I'm not saying I've found the truth or anything, I'm just reporting my work here, and this is up to others smarter than me to continue whether this is right or wrong. What this is a theory, and it's basically my book. So I'm sorry, I don't even dare to look at less than an hour at least. So questions we have?
This idea that we are living in a simulation which could not be a reality or an illusion, this is the Advaita understanding, because this is what Mayavad is, that the world is an illusion, and it's not, the material world is not a reality. Brahma, Satya, Jagan, Mithya, that's what Shankaracharya was preaching. How is it, how do we understand the way, the Advaita Vedanta and the Vaishnava understanding that this world is a reality, but it's temporary?
Yeah, I mean, many of those quantum physicists, they were Advaita, Advaitins, how you say it. Now, I could say one thing. You have the Nirguna and the Saguna, right? Mm-hmm. Nirguna is beyond the guna. It's no quality. And they take that to be the oneness. Yeah. There's no personality. There's nothing, really. It's just the one God. Yeah. But when you see the Bhagavatam talking about Nirguna and Saguna, You were not here when I showed that, but I was kind of looking at the this whole creation story of the Bhagavatam. When Mahavishnu is there, you know, and the Mahatattva appears. Mahatattva is consciousness that gets a little affected by the gunas. And the gunas mean that creative, you know, thing of passion you want to have, you know, this. That's what kind of gets the whole creation going, right? So the Mahatattva, as Prabhupada describes, is pure consciousness, a little bit affected by sattva guna, and then it continues, you know, one after another. Mind, sattva guna, intelligence, senses, that's rajaguna, and then this mahabhutas, physical elements, there are the ahankara in tamaguna, right? So what I'm saying this is that the understanding there of nirguna and saguna is that you go into those gunas, you know, the material modes of nature, this material creation, and that diversity there, that's false, right? But that's just a mirror of the diversity in the actual world. And the Mayavadis, they take nirgunas, meaning absolutely no qualities at all, which is just a negation, which doesn't make sense, right? It doesn't hold up, as we know, of course. So I would see it that way, if that answers.
Yeah. So, I appreciate the point that the Mayavadis, they don't consider the spiritual variety.
Yeah.
But they also say that this material world itself is an illusion.
It's a dream.
Yeah. But the Western understanding is that, are there any scientists who align more with the Western understanding, which is this world is there, it's not an illusion, but it's temporary, or identification with the material world is false? So I am there, but identifying myself, this body is also there, it's not an illusion, but I myself identifying with the body, that is an illusion.
Yeah. Now, you were not here. I can send you this whole thing. We recorded it so you can see, because I made that point that the Bhagavatam, the creation story of the Bhagavatam, describes this world as a dream. And Prabhupada emphasizes that over, and I have a file this thick with quotes from Prabhupada and the Shastra. He said, I mentioned this controversy they had, you know, how did we fall down for Vaikuntha? Did we or did we not? I don't know if you're aware, there was a big war in ISKCON about this. And Prabhupada said, there's a story about that, but I'm not going into it. Swarup told me, it's quite fascinating how the BBTers here, they found things that the others didn't find. And then, anyway, Prabhupada gave a lecture about this when he's emphasizing, saying that, no, it's a dream. We never fell down from Vaikuntha, because we are in Vaikuntha now. We are just dreaming. We forgot.
Yeah,
we're just dreaming it. So, you know, we sleep here, we can sleep in Vaikuntha also. That, you know, this is just a reflection of the real world. And sleep and dream there, the way I understand it, it's not some ignorant, you know, falling into, but it's a creative thing, you know. We just want, I want to be a god, and I want to be a king, you know. And then that's why this world exists. What I'm saying is that when you have that dream, you look at it from that perspective, which I then tried. I read the Bhagavatam really on Sanskrit verses, and then it went like, wow, wow, wow. It's like eye-opening. And it makes sense. And it's there in the Bhagavatam itself also, that it says straight out that this is a dream. So I don't know if that answers a little bit also what...
I've heard that version also, that this is a dream.
It's Mahavishnu's dream, right?
Yeah.
And we are little parts raised from Vishnu, from Purusha. And so we are also, you know, when he lies down in the causal ocean, we are there in his body in Sushupti, deep sleep. There's no dream yet. And then Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, then the dream starts to appear and the lotus sprouts there and the Virat Rupa inside there. That's when we then enter into the dream. And now we have entered into a dream and we think this is real. It's a very, very real looking dream, isn't it? just as tonight when you fall asleep, you will be in a dream and you will think that's reality. And we forgot this place. And therefore very very central in this knowledge, as you find it in Upanishads, is this Sushupti, Svapna, and Jagrat, and then Turiya, the Atma, who's going through those different realms on a daily basis. And actually, Mahavishnu represents Sushupti, Garbhalakshaya Vishnu represents Svapna, and Kshirdakshaya Vishnu represents Jagrat, and that's the Vishva, that's this, you know. So you find this there, this cycle. Actually, that cycle is represented by the Chaturvyuha. You find in the Bhagavatam all of it, that goes all the way from Vrindavan. You know, they have Krishna, Balaram, you have four there, and then you have the first Chaturvyuha, next one, and then for the creation of this world, you have Mahavishnu, Garbhadakshaya. Again, another Chaturvyuha. And above there is then Vasudeva, Narayan. So, I mean, I can go on forever, but I think, anything else? Did anyone understand anything what I'm talking about? I know this is a pretty wild thing to just throw at you like this in an hour, because that's why I had to write a book, because I couldn't explain it in any other way. But then I had to take that book and squeeze it into... I mean...
This Vedic planetarium in the temple of Vedic planetarium in Mayapur, how will it be designed? Do they have a ready plan? Do they have a clear arrangement how it will be designed?
Pranava probably knows more than I about that, because I haven't, you know, I've been working on my own when Harikesh left, he was in charge of it. Then I realized, you know, I'd take care of myself. So I was just continuing in this way, privately. He knows more. I'm a little bit in contact with the Bhaktivedanta Institute, but, you know, I'm not a PhD or anything, so nobody even reads what I write. Why should they care? So I decided I should produce a good, nice book with pictures in it and put it on their table, each and every one. Here it is, you know. And I don't know, does anything of this make sense to you, or is it like, what is this guy talking about? Yeah?
I had a question. What motivated you to write this, or like to work more on this concept of
Let me tell you what actually happened. I was a temple president in Gothenburg up to 97, and then I, you know, handed it over to him. And happily went to Mayapur, rented a little room there, cooked my own khichdi, and just chanting and studying, and it was wonderful. I arrived late at night, and just before deity greeting, so went into the temple, they opened there, Radha Madhava, Ashtashakhi, prayed to them as I normally do, please engage me in your service. And then I went out in the garden chanting my japa, and there was an exhibition hall there, a little one. It's been there since, I don't think it's there anymore, called the Expo. So I looked at that and I thought, wow, it's a nice little exhibition there, some Bhagavad Gita philosophy and things. But, you know, 3,000 visitors a day are coming there. So you could make a much nicer exhibition. I just thought about that for a second. That would be a nice thing. And then I just continued. Later that afternoon, I was walking at the same place, and one Brahmachari came running across the lawn, shouting my name, Priyavrata, and I had no idea how he knew who I was. He said, "You got a phone call." I said, "Okay, I just come into Mayapur." So then I went to Jayapataka Swami's office and got a phone call from Sweden, where the SMPDC were sitting, you know, leaders of the whole Mayapur project, the Temple of Vedic Planetarium. And they wanted someone to take care of that exhibition department. So they said, you know, we want a production manager and a conceptual developer, and we want you. And I said, never, you know, I just got out of a management position. But it was Paramananda, my old Sankirtan buddy, who was calling them. He was a secretary in that meeting. And he is very persuasive. So I just surrendered. And they handed me, I got an apartment in London next to the architectural office back then, not so far from Bhaktivedanta Manor. bunch of airplane tickets, and I was traveling around the world studying exhibitions and gathering artists. And I that's how, what happens when you pray to deities in Mayapur, you know. It was quite mind-blowing, actually. So I realized, you know, that after this, I mean, the whole project changed so much, and the new leader that came in after I came, they started kicking out us one after another. I just realized I have to take care of myself, so I moved back to Sweden. But I couldn't stop doing, because this was really my thing, I felt, you know. I wanted to understand the Bhagavatam, the cosmology of the Bhagavatam. And I'd just been praying, you know, please give me some, use me for something, you know, and then this just basically came to me. So for whatever it's worth, but to me there are things here that make sense. I don't know about you, if that answered your question.
But how to visualize it?
Someone else was, you had your hand?
No, I think Pavel.
Oh, it was Pavel, okay. You wanted to ask him?
Yeah,
not if the earth is flat or round.
Back to Godhead, so and then like meditate we fell down with like a spark of the fire fall down from the whole fire to the 3 months of nature. So mentioned that we never fall down, but I hear from Prabhupada very often that we fell down, we left Krishna.
Yeah, but that's the thing, you know, you can say things in different ways, right? But, I mean, it was Svarupa actually that got me into all this. And then I found one lecture that Prabhupada gave in New Vrindavan, I think. I can find it and I will put it in my book, I think. Very, you know, 68 or 9 or something. I don't know when New Vrindavan started, but very early. Because at that time, devotees had started asking that question, you know, how did we fall down? How did we fall down? And just as you were talking here, and then Prabhupada, he was, you know, someone was asking, and he was talking like this, that no, we didn't fall down. It's just a dream. And then this devotee said, but you know, when we can, how can we achieve liberation or something like that? Prabhupada said, you are already liberated. You just don't know it. And I mean, he said these kind of amazing things too. And with that, he meant that we have never left the spiritual world, never left Vaikuntha. We have just drifted away in a dream. And that's how he describes his entire cosmos. Of course, you can call that falling down, because now we are finding ourselves here in that dream, which seems very real, and we're going to go back again, like we saw there on the cycle of the 10 topics of the Bhagavatam. We're down here playing around in the dream, or the game. You can also use that metaphor. But then going, and that's how he expressed it. But to take it more, you know, deeper than he, I mean, I can show you, I have, as I said, a file, so many places where Prabhupada emphasizes this.
That we never fall.
That this is like a dream. We're just dreaming now. We have never left. Because we are, and if you think about it, we are the spirit, transcendental spirit soul, Satchidananda. And we are of that nature. And we are constitutionally, you know, on that spiritual level. That's where we are, but we think we are here. So, I mean, it's a topic where I know some devotees, they are not used to it. So we're making a lot about this in the book I'm writing also, and me and Svarup especially, he really got into research about that. It's quite mind-blowing when you see how much and how little we could understand. The disciples just didn't, we were such neophytes.
Yes, Prabhupada, can we fall down again when we go back to spiritual? Prabhupada, yes, you can fall down anytime.
Yeah, because he said, it's, you know, you can dream anytime. I mean, just take that as a kind of a, you know, example of how we dream here. It's up to you.
Mind, it, no, from on a spiritual point of view, there is no question of dream. I mean, under the emotions of nature.
Yeah, you can sleep and dream in the spiritual world.
Yeah,
Mahavishnu can sleep and dream. And you know how it is stated, there's a kind of a cloud in Vaikuntha, you know, and that's where Mahavishnu lies down in the causal ocean. You can see that as a kind of dreamy cloud in the consciousness like that. But Mahavishnu, again, is pointed out, Prabhupada also mentioned, he doesn't go into an ignorant sleep. He's transcendental. He does it for pastime. And I would say that we, in the transcendental realm, we can also sleep, but not in this ignorant way that is here. It's more a creative thing. We can imagine anything we want, and we can experience it if we want. We have that freedom. And that is what this world is. Don't ask me more, because I don't know, you know, will we go back here again or not? You know, that's, I guess, that Prabhupada said what you said also, and it's up to us, I guess. And, you know, but this is here. This
dream, of course, Prabhupada said we are in a daytime dream and a nighttime dream. Only difference is the daytime is longer.
Yeah.
Time is that's the only difference. That's clear. But just to connect to the spirit.
If Prabhupada said like that we don't fall from the spiritual world, then why is there such a controversy on this issue? Because someone wrote a book on this, Satyanarayan Babaji. And he was expelled from ISKCON.
Not even
Yeah, but that they got into something very dangerous close to Mayavad. Because what they say is that, we never fell down, you know, not even a leaf falls down in Vaikuntha, right? Because in that case, we would have been fools or something like that. So we were never in Vaikuntha. We can never have been there. And they come with all kinds of things. We came from the Tathashta Shakti, from the, you know, Brahman somewhere, you know. And now we're about to go back to Vaikuntha. We were never with Krishna. And I say, this is pretty much Mayavad. In a way, because then the ultimate position, you know, where we came from is kind of impersonal almost. So that's why there was this great debate. And then you have the other side. And what the interesting thing is that then you have the GBC back then, that was, you know, they also wrote a book. What is it? Our original position. And the other one was, there were a few of them. And that's when Swarup started talking, because the thing is, the GBC side then who wrote that book, actually they ordered Harikesh Swami to make the book because he had BBT here. So he just came to those BBT devotees and threw some script and said, you should make this book yesterday. You know, it's always like, immediately we're going to push it out. And then the devotees there in BBT, they found that lecture where Prabhupada, I don't know if you were here when I mentioned that. It's from Tokyo. I can give you the exact lecture from 72, where he was pushing that thing, that this, we never fell from Vaikuntha. We are just, this is just a dream. And you can wake up in a second and you're back again to Godhead. It's just a question of consciousness. And he said, you know, you might dream there's a tiger chasing you, but there is no tiger. So even the dangers we can experience here, nightmares, it's just a dream. So, and he said, this is very, very important. He was like several times probably pounding his fist. You know, this is so important to understand. But somehow or other, what happened then was that those devotees there who found that lecture, they went to Harikesh Swami with it and said, we want this one included in the book, our original position. And I mean, this is kind of funny. Harikesh Swami read that and he said, well, this is controversial. So now Prabhupada was controversial. Swarup was laughing when telling, because they had already those two sides, you know. And it was the question, is this right or is that one right? And they were fighting. And then they come another third one, which actually came from Prabhupada, and they just ignored it. And they got a little part of a lecture into that book, actually. The original position. But, you know, you should put Swarup here because he really knows about all this. Quite interesting, actually, how it happened. And the funny thing is, I came into this dream understanding from the cosmology of the Bhagavatam. He came into it from that issue, Swarup. And then we met, you know, just a few years ago, and we realized, my goodness, we came to the right, exactly same conclusion here from the Bhagavatam and from the teachings of Prabhupada. No, Svarup Prabhu, he used to work in the BBT here, now he lives south of Sweden. So that's a topic that we can have a whole lecture about also. I mean, no, I don't want to take any much time more. We can discuss if you want, because this is all there in my book. Someone else was raising some.
I just heard once, I don't know who it was, who said that when we wake up, or what to say, from this illusion and come back to the spiritual realm, no time has been going on.
Yeah, I also heard that. But it's like, you know, when you make a, I think this dream metaphor is one, but I like the one to see everything, you know, this like a virtual reality game, like a game. You know, when you've played computer games, you know, you are in the world there, you have your avatar, your game character running around there, and after a while it's over and you're, okay, shall I play it again or next level or something? It's a good metaphor, I think. And then you can also, how was it you said now? I'm getting a little tired. Because it fit
back.
There.
No time has
oh, yeah.
Passed.
You know, then those who make those games, they also create time within the game. You know, if you go to, what is it? Hey, what is it? The game, you know, the hacking in Minecraft. If you go into those games, sometimes it's night, sometimes it's day. The programmers made their own time in there. So therefore, there's certain time here, certain time in Bhuvarloka, certain time in Svargaloka. And yeah, I heard that, I mean, from the reality point of view, this is just a little imagination flash, you know. We just drifted off a little and got into all of this. This is the power we have. We can make very good, you know, it's like an amusement park for us, you could see, I would say. I think that's a good, or a game. And I don't even think we can say that, this is just my view on it, that this falling down thing that we go into this, I see it more from that level, that it's nothing, it's not good or bad, it's just we have that ability and then we do it and then it's over and it's fine, life goes on. It was just a little I like to see it that way at least. In any case, I mean, if you came here to understand if the earth is flat or round and all of that and all the dvipas and varshas and all of that, I could speak about that too, but I think that's a secondary importance, and it can take our focus from the real thing, because you may have noticed that now we have been speaking about Krishna, isn't it? and the spiritual world and everything, not about distances between planets and, you know, this and that and with calculators. I say that when you get into that, you are too influenced by Western physicalist, materialist thinking. So this in a way is a little bit of a challenge, I know, because I think that other kind of thinking is still a little bit common in among some devotees, I don't know. So yeah.
Only one last question. It may sound dumb, but is it one of the hypotheses?
What?
Is it a kind of hypothesis, like theory?
Well, what I can say, what I have been speaking now, and that book I'm writing, I used to be a little bit speculating when I was young. So I'm very careful not to do that anymore. Everything I said here, I can back with quotes from the Bhagavatam, direct quotes from the Bhagavatam. And I'm doing that in my book. It's just filled with footnotes everywhere, because I really simply, and this is what I started with, I simply want to understand the Bhagavatam as it is, not interpretations, as little as possible. Of course, you always need to interpret words. But, you know, so I'm really trying to stick. So I dare say that what you heard here today was just plain Bhagavatam. although I then chose to look at it from, again, what the Bhagavatam itself says, its dream perspective. And that maybe some are not used to, but it's just there. So, but you know, it's good to want to check facts, and when that book comes out, you can see all of them and ask more.
So if somebody on the street asks me, or they ask me people, so planet Earth is a flat or round, what should I answer?
What was that question?
If planet Earth is round or flat, what should be my answer? Until now, I'm not sure.
Is there anyone here who thinks that the Earth is flat? I mean, it's ridiculous. Anyone can understand it's round.
Robert,
I mean,
said, whenever I see
No. Look here, I told you. Now we're getting into that also. But you know, there I found in the Bhagavatam, they call the earth Bo Gulam. That's one word, you find it in the Bhagavatam. Bo Gulam. And Prabhupada says, Gula means a round ball like that, isn't it? So this shows that they knew at that time that the earth is round.
It's in the
Bhagavatam, and Prabhupada mentions it. I can show you the quote, well, I have it somewhere. And if you think about it, it's very easy to figure out that the world is round. You go to another place and you measure how the light falls. So, I mean, they had, you know, the old Sumerians, the old Babylonians, they knew the world was round.
Imperfect senses.
Well, you know, yeah, but you can always say that, you know. It's flat, but we have imperfect senses. So, yeah, you know, that's my explanation. But you can just say any madness and then say, but, you know, you don't see that because your senses are imperfect.
I wonder what is in the scriptures. What is scriptures?
That's, I just told you. It's there.
But there's only one evidence. Like, there are more evidences. Like,
you know, the Bhagavatam does not waste time and space with that. It's a very mundane topic.
But this will create whole, this model itself, it will create lots of questions. So we have to be ready to answer any question.
Yeah, but that's not what Prabhupada is teaching us about bhakti, about the cosmology, about, not about the shape of the earth. What do you have to do with that?
But people, they want to know.
Why do they? Would anyone ask you, you know, Hare Krishna guy, is the earth flat or round? I mean, what do we care?
Until
I don't care even what it is.
Until now, devotees, they still...
Yeah, devotees got too much into this. I'm just trying to get them out of it and back to the actual Bhagavatam and what it actually matters here. And therefore, I'm saying this actual cosmology of the Bhagavatam is about this, a consciousness-centered cosmology where we can show... Actually, I forgot one picture I'm going to make. Bhagavatam describes this whole thing, how everything starts with Krishna and expands different forms of Vishnu, different realms, you know, Vrindavan, Mathura, Dwarka. That's the cosmology, and then how this material world is a part of that, the spiritual creation and material. That's the actual cosmology of the Bhagavatam. Not something about, I mean, this planet, something that's on the lowest level of Burloka.
But it's part of it.
Well, if you want to, you know, spend your time with that, then you're welcome.
I just told you,
because Prabhupada doesn't spend too much time with that either, because he had better things to talk about, you know, bhakti and all of that. But he mentioned it, and I just found it there. This Bo Gulam is mentioned, and he then said that Earth is round. So that's enough for me, because, you know, the rest of science today, I mean, there's so much evidence that the Earth is round. This is just.
Why is so much rumor about it?
Because people today are so ignorant and stupid. Sorry to say it, but humanity has become so ignorant and stupid, they start to think the Earth is flat. Come on.
Reason how came to this idea even?
I have no idea. Maybe it's because they think this mandala, you know, it's a flat disk.
Yeah.
But mandala can also be three-dimensional. It can be a sphere also.
Bhumandala can be a system of planets, which is can be a plane, like it can be a plane rather than a piece of land.
Yeah, and I'll tell you something. I looked up the word Bhumandala in Veda base. Okay, you find it in, I think it was 9 places in the whole Bhagavatam. And it's only about, for example, that Lord Maharaj Prithu, he ruled over the entire Bhumandala. you know, and this other king ruled over the entire Bhumandala. So it sounds there that they just use the world as, you know, the world, you know, the earth as far as you can see, you know, or far and wide. So I think that what you're saying, that I even have, you know, I had some images about this. Let me just show, since you're anyway asking, just my theory about Bhumandala, because you don't find anything, you know, about some kind of flat earth out there in space, but just this very brief, now this crash, but you stand here and you look around, you see horizon around you, a surface, right? That's earthly surface that you see. That is Bhumandala.
Which is before.
I think that's how they use the word.
I talk about our research Santipambrabhu, this Adhuva Bhaktivika Swami, and he said, no, a planet is not round. His Bhaktivika Swami, he's saying that his description planet Earth as cartel, the Prabhupada saying as a cartel or lotus petal.
Yeah, I mean, the Bhumandala is described, you know, the Bhuvar log is described as a lotus shape. And, you know, I think I got into it in the book, but, you know, this is kind of esoteric stuff. Yeah, but, you know, you speak to someone who is expert on that, you know, this astronomy stuff and all these shapes of things. Yeah, I mean, the way to say something about the astronomy there, there is astronomy, the Bhagavatam, but if you really look at it, how is describing how planets and the sun and their orbits and locations and all of that, that astronomy in the Puranic age was very close linked to astrology. Same here, actually, the, you know, Tycho Brahe and all these people, they were also into astrology, actually, big astronomers. So they were kind of going into each other. And if you look at the way astrology describes the solar system, for instance, you have, you know, us in the middle, the planets going around. That doesn't mean it's a geocentric view. It's an observer-centric view, you could say, right?
It's relative.
Huh?
It's relative.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is, if you ask me, that the astronomy, the astronomical references in the Bhagavatam are describing the heavenly bodies as they move above our heads in the sky and in relation to the zodiac, the ecliptic. And I can prove it. You can take it one after another and you will find that. I have a whole thing about it, but it's getting too late. That's the astronomy in those age. And nowadays they have this astronomy where they imagine to look at the cosmos from outside, you know, and this is a kind of coordinate system and 3D positioning like that. They didn't have that astronomy back then. They used astronomy only for, you know, navigation, for calendars, for very practical purposes. Here is the sun. And it's interesting because there is this verse in the Bhagavatam where it says in the fifth canto that the sun is in the middle of the universe. I thought, wow, what does that mean? Is it above the water there or in that bubble? You know, it goes like... If you look at the words, actually, that are used in Sanskrit, I forgot exactly the words, but there are two words, and the one means earth, down here on the ground, and the other one means up in the heaven, in the sky, this sky dome. So it means that the sun is somewhere up there. You know, which it is. You just see it. It's just a couple of words, you know, by the way. And what's actually being described there about the sun is more about the how the sun represents Vishnu and, you know, the seasons and how God nourishes us by the season. So they actually use the astronomy and the Bhagavatam is just used to describe, you know, the planets, for instance, how they are representing different qualities and characteristics, you know, of Vishnu, different powers like that. So it's all set there in that cosmology of the Bhagavad, of the, you know, personal Krishna conscious perspective. Anyway, I mean, we can talk a lot about it, but I think now you're getting a little tired.
I think Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati was expert, right, on cosmology.
Yeah, because, you know, then you have Jyotish. You have that coming later in India, And I think that was also pretty much influenced with the Greek. They had some kind of cooperation or exchange then, like 500 before Christ or something like that. But that's a different kind of astronomy that started to appear then. We are talking about the Puranic astronomy, which is, I still say that the Bhagavatam is 5,000 years old or something. So the Puranic age is, you know, they had a different, I mean, we can really talk about this ancient, and maybe someone knows more than I, but anyway, I'm pulling out of the astronomy question here, but thank you so much, everyone, and I hope...
Det var verkligen roligt. This was very, very great.
Oh, you're so polite. Well, I hope, you know, that something made sense to you. Okay, Hare Krishna. Thank you.
A little point that in April, I think, some from the Temple of the Planetarium team is coming to Sweden as well to present at the Temple of the Planetarium in Mayapur.
Where?
So in April?
Yes, but where? Where?
Maybe even here, in Amis Court. Maybe that's a plan, right? Discussions. So that's what we